pay enthusiasm lay. A way oddcast pay at they enthusiastic way about way linguistics lay.
Hang on, wait. We are not going to do the whole episode in Pig Latin, are we?
No.
Okay. Welcome to Lingthusiasm, a podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. I'm Lauren Gorn.
And I'm Gretchen McCulloch, and I speak Pig Latin.
In this sixth bonus Patreon episode, we are going to be talking about language games.
Language games, language play, suggested by our patrons. We've also got our next bonus topic decided because the voting was so close and this is not an election, we don't have to choose a single candidate. So next time we'll be bringing you linguistics research, how to do it if you don't have any money.
And topics that we would love to see researched in linguistics, so we're really excited about that topic as well. That also means for our $10 patrons who have the option of suggesting topics to us, you have an extra month to brainstorm ideas for topics you would like to hear on the show.
And because we know you all like voting, we'll give you a different fun poll to participate in for all patrons, so you still get to vote on something. Topic to be discovered.
Today's bonus, though, is language games, which is often talked about in the literature in linguistics as language play or speech play or something like that. But we think of them as language games and ways to play with language, but basically play with how language works to create a way of speaking that sounds entertaining to a particular group of people.
And so one example that's probably the best known example in English of language play is Pig Latin, where you take the first consonant or group of consonants from the beginning of a word and you move it to the end and you add A, the sound A, to it. But there are other examples as well.
There are so many examples. And the thing with language games is we often think of those like change sounds in a syllable, but language games and language play happen at all levels of language. So it happens at the phonetic level with playing with those sounds. It can happen with morphology, so moving morphemes around. It can happen with words. So if you think about it, like punning is actually a form of language game and is taken more or less seriously by different people. And it can happen at the entire sentence level of playing around with sentence order and those kind of things. And there's a really great book by Joel Scherzer. So I read quite a lot about language play while looking at LOLspeak, and we'll talk about memes later on. But Joel Scherzer's book makes this really great point that language play can play with language in different ways. So it can play with the sounds, or like what we think of in linguistics as the signifiers. So things like rhyming or alliteration really play with the physical properties of that sound. Or it can play with the signifier, so the meaning, so like metaphor.
And so things like tongue twisters or like Cockney rhyming slang.
Yeah. So would be playing with the physical properties of the sound. But you can also play with the meaning of words. So that's where things like metaphor come in. Or you can play with the relationship between how a word sounds and what it means. And that's really what a pun is, right? You make something sound like one thing, but it also can mean another thing. And that's where the funniness comes from, or the like pain comes from, depending on how you feel about puns. And so that's why I love talking about language play so much, because it encompasses so many different parts of language. And it's something that is like pervasive across all cultures. So we have Pig Latin, but there are a whole variety we'll link to. There's a really great Wikipedia page that just lists all these different ways of playing with language across different languages or different subgroups of English speakers. And that's why I get really excited about it.
And one of the other cool things about language play is that it can teach us about how people conceive of language or how language is represented in the mind.
Yeah.
So an example of this with Pig Latin is we don't just move the first letter to the end of a word, because letters aren't, you know, they're not as psychologically real as sounds are. And so if a word begins with a silent letter, you ignore that. So if you have something like pneumonia, you don't have umonia, pne, or something like that, because the P is silent. And if it begins with a consonant cluster, if it begins with multiple consonants, you move the whole group of consonants to the end. So if you have something like slight, that would be eit slay, not light say.
Yep.
So it which shows that we're treating this whole group of consonants together as a unit at the beginning of a word. So you could kind of use them to probe into what's psycholinguistically real.
Yeah, and it varies across languages. So there might be languages where the consonant cluster isn't as important or for some historical reason, and then it would be light say instead of eit slay. And that's what you can use it to kind of see what because people actually do have these subconscious understandings of how the language works, and they show through in language play.
And a lot of language play takes place, if it's going to happen in a syllable, it often takes place at the boundary between the consonants at the beginning and the vowel in the middle, or the rhyming part, or the part at the beginning that doesn't rhyme. Which shows like rhymes have a certain type of importance, and it's less likely to happen. I don't know of any language games that do this, where you have the consonant at the beginning plus the vowel, and then the consonant at the end of the syllable like is separate and does something different. So there's like there's igte atenle, but in theory there could be gape ne lat.
You really had to think about that, didn't you?
I really had to think about that one, which would be if instead of taking the first sound and putting it at the end with A, you take the last sound and put it at the beginning with A.
Yeah.
And like in theory, like if you're a computer, this is like just as easy for you. But if you're a human, this is really hard.
Yeah. So it shows that psychological insight.
So psychologically, we think of the vowel as being more closely bound to the consonant that comes after than the consonant that comes before it.
And I mean, the whole idea of doing this kind of thing is that you practice it and get used to the modification, and then you can understand it better than people who don't know how this process works.
Mm-hmm. And there's other games that do this that have the same syllable split as well. So one that's known as Gibberish or Abish or Abish, or apparently Abba speak in German, puts a syllable like ab or ob in the middle of every syllable. So if you have something like pig, you'd have pawbig. And again, it's between that initial consonant and the vowel plus whatever comes after.
The German one is even cooler for aber speak in German, because it's just the vowel in the syllable B and then the vowel in the syllable again. So it'd be pibib, pibig.
Oh, so you keep the same vowel. Okay.
Yeah. So, you're doing a kind of more on the go in your brain reel. And it's really impressive how people can do this almost at the rate of normal speech. And actually, children are often really good at picking up things like pig Latin much quicker than adults, because they still have that kind of the same kind of neurological flexibility that allows them to pick up and sound more native in accents and languages quicker than adults.
Yeah, I used to be really good at pig Latin when I was a kid, and then I stopped really paying attention to it for a number of years, and then I learned French, and I got fairly good at French, and then when I went back to try to speak pig Latin again as a teenager, I kept trying to pig Latinify French words. Because, I don't know, maybe they must have been in the same, like, some sort of neighboring area of my brain that was like, oh, here's where you do the language stuff.
In that generic, it's not just default English stuff. Did you ever learn, is it Verlan in French?
So I learned about Verlan, which is the best known French language game. I can't actually speak it because it is weird, but it's really cool. So I learned about it in French class, and the name Verlan, V-E-R-L-A-N, I can't pronounce French words as if they're Englishy, I'm sorry, comes from the word l'envers, which means inverse.
Okay.
And so what you do is you take the two syllables of a word and you swap their orders.
Okay.
So instead of inverse, you'd get versin, essentially, if you're going to do that in English.
Okay. So instead of playing around within the syllable, which is what pig Latin's doing, it's like pulling the syllable apart. This is keeping the syllables but moving their order.
Yeah. So, for example, français would become c'est franc, because you have français, c'est franc.
Right.
And apparently, so I was doing some research on Wikipedia about Verlan, but I was using the French Wikipedia because, well, I speak French and it's much more comprehensive for Verlan than the English one.
Not surprised.
Not surprisingly. And it's the kind of thing, I really like a Wikipedia article for this because it comes kind of like a folk linguistic text. Mm-hmm. And so there's not very many citations in this. But there's a few opinions that sneak in.
Okay.
And so you're like, people have been editing this who just speak Verlan and they have opinions about it.
Right.
So apparently it may go back to the Middle Ages, Verlan, or some what? Sort of thing like Verlan in
no
French.
No way.
And there are definitely recordings of it back to the 16th century.
Whoa. People were using this when Shakespeare was writing English. That is...
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's so well. So one very early example is from the story Tristan and Isolde. I don't actually know how you say her name.
Yeah.
Which is one of these like epic, you know, romance myths. And somebody changed the name Tristan to Tantris.
Ah.
Oh. Because I guess you could do that. But it became especially popular in France during World War II. And one of the theories is that this was because of the occupation of France at that time. And so French people were trying to not be understood by the Nazis.
Right. Okay. I mean, that is one reason that this kind of language often arises. People talk about Polari in English, which was used by a lot of kind of urban gay community in England mm-hmm. in the 50s and in the 20s and even earlier, as a way of being able to talk about what they wanted to talk about without people outside their group understanding them.
I think people talk about Cockney rhyming slang as doing a similar thing in some cases.
Yeah.
Not being understood by people, but I don't know very much about rhyming slang. So Verlan has this thing where you swap the syllables. Which sounds great.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that, obviously not all words are two syllables in French.
Yes.
And so how do you do this on a word?
How do you do this?
If you doesn't have two syllables. And so one thing to point out about Verlan is, so unlike Pig Latin, so in Pig Latin, you make every word into Pig Latin in a sentence.
Yeah.
Verlan, you tend to just do certain target words.
Okay.
So I guess in principle, you could make a whole sentence into Verlan, but you don't tend to do that. You tend to just use kind of your nouns and verbs mostly, and not okay. all of your little function words in between them.
Yeah.
You can, but it's less common, I guess. So there's a couple things you can do to make a word have two syllables again. One of the things is that a lot of French words end in a silent E. And French already has this option where you can kind of restore a silent E at the end. So in English, if a word has a silent E, same, there's never any context in where you'd say same.
Yeah.
That's just totally bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But in French, if you want to emphasize a word, you can pronounce it silent E.
Okay.
And that's a reasonable thing to do in French.
Right.
So if you have a word like femme, which means woman, you can say femme if you want to be really emphatic about that.
Okay.
So if a word has a silent E, you can restore it.
Yay!
If a word is monosyllabic and doesn't have a silent E, you can add one.
Oh, okay. Since you've got that strategy for words that do have it, you can just appropriate it for non...
Yeah.
Okay.
So flick, which means movie, you can make flick.
So you really have to know how the language works and then extend it and know that that's what someone is doing deliberately.
Oh, that's just the beginning.
Right, yeah.
Or if a word is monosyllabic and already ends with a vowel.
Yeah.
But it has a consonant there that's not pronounced. You can restore the consonant and then add a silent E.
Okay. Fabulous.
So the word nez, which means nose, is spelled N-E-Z. And so you restore the silent Z and then you add an E on the end.
So all of those silent letters suddenly have a usefulness.
So they all show up again. And it shows that partly because you can emphasize stuff with silent letters, but it shows that there's a very different psycholinguistic attitude towards silent word final letters in French than there is in English. Because in English, that would be really weird to try to restore these letters.
In English, they're just some weird spelling, nostalgia trip.
But in French, they're kind of latently there. Or you can delete a vowel if it's too many syllables.
Okay.
So if you have a word like énervé, which means anxious or nervous, mm-hmm. You can just make it nervé.
Okay.
Or sometimes you delete the beginning vowel, sometimes you delete the end vowel. I don't know what the system is for this.
Of course,
whatever.
Because you're an outsider, Gretchen.
I'm an outsider. I'm not a native speaker. Yeah. And even, Quebec French does not do very much for Verlan. It may do a little bit, but it's not super common in Quebec. It is really a France thing. And French Wikipedia supports me on this. They're like, yeah, it's not really that much in, even in, like, it, I guess it's not that much in Belgium or Switzerland either, but it's like, really a very France thing. But okay. It is, and, like, especially Parisian, but, like, not just Paris. And so then you chop it up, and you split it, so then you have fameux, and you split that to, fumat. And yeah. Then what you do, so you're like, okay, fine, I kind of understand how to do this. Then what you do is you often chop off the final vowel, because final vowels aren't very good in French.
Right, so you flip the vowels and then you get rid of it.
And then you get rid of the one that was originally in the word. So the verlan for femme is not meufa, it's meuf.
Okay, so like Cockney rhyming slang, just to digress, because you don't, you said, like, so with Cockney rhyming slang, you start off with words that rhyme. So China plate rhymes with mate.
Mm-hmm.
So you have something that's like at least two syllables that rhymes with something that's one syllable, and then you drop the rhyming syllable off. So mate is China plate, and then you drop the plate off, and you've just got China, which right. To an outsider seems completely unrelated. And so that's where, so like with verlan and rhyming, Cockney rhyming slang, although it's used in Australian English too, so I'm just going to call it rhyming slang.
Oh, good. Okay, let's just call it rhyming slang then.
You move a step beyond the obvious relationship between the two, whereas with Pig Latin, it's always restorable pretty directly.
It's restorable, and it's kind of transparent.
Yeah.
So you inverse it, and then you short it. So sometimes this gets... So if you have flick... So you have to lengthen that to be flicker.
Yeah.
And then you swap them, so you have kerfli. And then you drop it, so now it's just kerf.
Kerf, okay.
And I'm not making up these examples, I'm stealing these examples directly from French Wikipedia, because I don't trust myself to make them. Because, like, yeah. Again, like, you have all of this kind of weird idiosyncratic bit to do that. And because the final result is several steps removed from the original word, you can then re-verlanize it once it's, like, really acquired status as a word in itself. So femme to meuf is probably the best known example of verlan. It shows up, like, everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's, and you can say, like, ma meuf, which means, like, my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also say this about, well, ma femme is my wife. So I guess it's slightly different in register there.
Yeah.
And then you can re-verlanize meuf to femeux, which does not sound like femme because you've gotten rid of that vowel.
Right. So that becomes the, like, re-verlan form.
Yeah. Re-verlanization. I don't know. I just made that word up.
So because it's now, like, known by enough people and it's become standardized, you need it to become covert again.
Yeah. The most interesting example of this that I found on French Wikipedia was that, verlan is also really widely associated with Arabic immigrants in France,
okay.
who live in the banlieue, like the suburbs around Paris.
Yep.
And it's like they don't have a lot of economic opportunity, and they're like, they produce a lot of rap music. And so verlan is associated with rap music, and it's associated with, like, disadvantaged youths. And so the verlan for Arab is beurre, which is used for... So beurre apparently generally refers to first-generation Arabic immigrants in France.
Right.
And then beurre got re-verlanized to rebeu. And that's apparently used to refer to second-generation immigrants.
Ah, okay.
And so they're, like, associated with different, like, time periods when they got verlanized.
Right.
And so I think that's, yeah, I think that's just really interesting. So there's an entire, when I was researching this, I found there's an entire book about verlan, which is in English, and a large portion of it is on Google Books, apparently.
Fabulous.
So you can read it if you like.
We'll put that in the show links.
And it's called Talking Backwards, Looking Forwards, The French Language Game Verlan. So we can link to that if you want to read an entire book about verlan.
I think it's also worth just, even if you, like, Pig Latin kind of missed me at school, but if you do any memeing on the internet, you are engaging in language play,
mm-hmm.
and often a fairly, like, strenuous high level type of language play. So when we were looking at LOLspeak, what became really apparent about that compared to what people were talking about with like Pig Latin or metaphors or whatever, is that you're often working across the whole of language all at the same time. Like you're doing things with the sound system and with the writing system and with word order and with metaphor and with particular sound, like turning words into particular sounds consistently or semi-consistently. And so it actually takes a lot of linguistic knowledge to do that all at once to the right balance. And it's often once one group has kind of got their little in-group niche memes and then someone starts a new one, and there's a lot of turnaround in how quickly people move to associate with new ways of playing with language.
Yeah, and I think especially on the internet, where a large part of like showing that you're part of an in-group is being able to talk like you're part of that in-group, because you can't wear like the t-shirt that's associated with them because nobody can see your t-shirt.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of this like showing that you're a member. I think even in the case of not just memes, but also kind of acronym-based stuff. I mean, acronyms are used for jargon in lots of different places. But for internet jargon, for example, one that I can think of is the fandom term OTP, which stands for one true pairing. So originally it gets used for if you have two people in a show that you want them to get together and you're like, this is the pairing that I really want. So let's say you're watching like BBC right. Sherlock and you're like, Sherlock and John really need to be in a relationship right now. So they can be your OTP and it's like the most important pairing to you. But it gets kind of semantically broadened as OTP is like any, you know, two people that you really want to get together. And then sometimes people also want three people to get together. And so that gets changed to OT3. And so like the three, like, but one, two, three, right. Like one true three, it's not threesome or T or something. It's literally the number three. So that substitution only works when you have the acronym as a word itself already. And then you've done something else with the acronym. Another example is BroTP. So that's when you have to, you want two people to get together, but only as like friends, not as a relationship. And so there again, you're taking like the bro combining form and putting that onto an acronym, because it's not bro true pairing. It's just you have OTP as a word now, and so you can smush bro into it.
Yeah, I think this is why language games and wordplay just hit a really sweet spot of linguistic love for me, because it's about complex manipulation of linguistic systems, but it's also so much about identity and which group you hang out with, and whether you're using this to kind of push back against, like if you're a French or a second generation migrant who's trying to find their place in a society that may not always be welcoming, or if you were a World War II era French person trying to avoid the Nazi kind of invasion of France, like there's so, or even if you're just a like 22-year-old on Tumblr who wants to show that they're part of this community, language play is a really great way for humans to do that.
Yeah. And to, you know, provide this thing that can be kind of opaque to outsiders and keep your secrets and so on. The other thing that came up when we were thinking about linguistics games is there's also, in addition to language games that you can analyze linguistically, there are also board games that you can play in a linguistic sort of way. It's a bit of a different, genre. But so one thing that people have done is play Scrabble with IPA symbols, which you may recall from our International Phonetic Alphabet episode. So you can make your Scrabble symbols into IPA symbols, give them frequencies and give them points. And if anybody wants to do this, I have posted on my blog a link to different like frequency and point values that you can use, which have been play tested.
There's also Cards Against Humanity, a group of people made a Linguists Against Humanity subset. So if you want to use your linguistic knowledge inappropriately, you can drop those Linguists Against Humanity subset cards into your game.
I've also recommended Taboo as a game to play about metalinguistic awareness in language learning. So Taboo is a game where you are given you draw a card and it has a word on it that you're trying to get people to guess. So it might be like something like game. And then it has five other words that you're not allowed to say when you're trying to get people to guess it. So they might be play and board and cards and... Win or something like this. And so you're trying to say, well, this is a thing that you do with your friends at a table. And people are guessing eat and stuff and so on and this. And the reason I think it's a useful metaphor for language learning is because a lot of what you're doing when you're speaking other languages, you don't have all the vocabulary that you do in your native language. And so you're trying to figure out how to express stuff that you don't have necessarily have the words for, but you can kind of talk around. And so practicing the skill of talking around in a very fun game, but it's very popular among linguists.
And another game that's popular among linguists is the internet, the great language game, where you listen to snippets of different languages and guess what language it is. You can put your linguistic deductive reasoning and luck to the test there.
And I think they've done a study from that game with the data from people about which languages are most commonly confused.
Have indeed. We'll link to that in the show notes as well.
For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I can be found as @GretchenAMC on Twitter, and my blog is allthingslinguistic.com.
I tweet and blog as Superlinguo. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gorn. Our producer is Claire, and our music is by The Triangles.
Thanks so much for being a patron, and
thanks, guys. Stay lingthusiastic.
Stay lingthusiastic.